This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network today. We're talking about preoperative educational programs and the difference that they can make during and after an orthopedic surgery. Back with us are Lori Tyne Brody, a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Hi, ladies.
Good morning.
Hello.
We'll also take your questions, of course. So have you recently had orthopedic surgery? Are you scheduled for one? Well, what questions do you have about what recovery will be like? And, of course, we can take general physical therapy questions also. Join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Lori, what exactly is a preoperative educational program?
That's a really good question. And a recent article that Jill and I reviewed showed that there is tremendous variability in preoperative educational programs. They have really come about relatively recently with the increase in total joint surgery. So total knee replacements, total hip replacements, total shoulder replacements. There are some educational programs prior to spinal surgeries as well. But what this paper that we reviewed recently found was that there's a great deal of variability in these programs. Some of them are designed to tell you, like, what are you going to do afterwards? What are your restrictions going to be? Other ones are designed to teach you the post-operative exercise program. What are you going to be doing after exercises? But it was interesting, you opened with the question of, like, what questions about, you know, what kind of questions are answered about your recovery? Like, what will your recovery be like? You know, unfortunately, patients were not really consulted in the design of any of these educational programs. So most of it comes from the provider end of what do I want my patients to know, rather than what do the patients want to know? What are they curious about after their surgery? And that set of questions and expectations may be very different from the provider side. So I would encourage people when they meet with their providers, that typically the surgeons or the physician associates that they meet prior to surgery, to come with their questions. What questions do you have? What are your concerns about the post-operative period so that your questions can be answered and you have an understanding of what your recovery might be like?
Go ahead, Jill.
And the other challenge with this was the delivery method for which all of these educational programs were delivered. So we know everyone has a little bit different learning style. So if you think about the population that's probably undergoing total joint arthroplasty, they may be a little bit older. So perhaps a pamphlet with font that isn't big enough for them to read isn't going to be helpful. Maybe they'd be better watching a video with someone who is relatable on the video. So all those things need to be considered. The other challenge, I think, with many of these is the education at the coffee clutches. So we all know that, you know, people talk, you know, oh, I have a friend who had a total knee replacement. Would you like to talk to them? And everyone's experience is incredibly different. And comorbidities, pre-existing conditions, medical history, social support, family support, compliance with rehabilitation, all of those factors can affect the individual's outcome. And so you'll hear people say, including our mother, you know, well, why is it taking me longer to get better than it took such and such? Is it because my surgeon wasn't as good? What's going on? And so you know, unfortunately, it's comparing apples to oranges. And so I think a lot of physical therapy education with our patient comes from that, feeling like I have to talk a patient down a little bit when they're upset that, gosh, such and such got rid of their walker at 4 weeks, and here I am 5 weeks, and I'm still on my walker. So I think a lot of comparison happens, and that can become very challenging for the patient.
And challenging for the caregiver, too, I would assume.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. One of the things this research found is that there was no difference in outcomes for people who underwent these educational programs and people who didn't. And this is a problem with many of our outcome tools, in that the change or the difference from pre to post is so strongly impacted by the surgery itself that the margin of benefit left for the educational program is so small that you can't really detect a difference. And interestingly, one of the reasons they said they did these programs was to relieve patients' anxiety about their surgical procedure, yet they never measured their pre- and post-anxiety levels to see whether or not there actually was a change in their anxiety about it.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that very same question, because to me, the mental stress of not knowing exactly what was going to happen would be difficult. So that education would be helpful. But why didn't they measure that?
Right, right.
It totally makes sense.
Yes.
So what should a person do besides asking questions of their provider? Is there anything else they can do to prepare, to understand what's going to happen during the surgery and after?
Well, I think asking questions early and often is helpful, because we all know that, you know, it's that you may hear it, but you don't really process it. So as a physical therapist, if you're seeing a patient, let's say they have some degenerative changes in their knee, and you're seeing them for exercise, and maybe you've bought them some time, but now it's time for a total knee replacement, to start having that conversation with them very early and saying, you know, this is kind of what's going to go on, here are some things, and let them kind of process a little bit. And then they can come back in the next visit and say, so you mentioned such and such, I have another question about that. You know, how am I going to do stairs, things like that. So I think for a lot of people, it's processing, it takes time to process that. It is so much information for someone in a very short amount of time, and it's very overwhelming. And even if they have a spouse or significant other partner there with them to hear everything, it's still just a lot to take in. It's like drinking from a fire hose. You know, here are these 27 papers. Every question that you need answered will be in here somewhere. So it can be really overwhelming to people, and then they just shut down.
Right. Yeah, I think we've all experienced that. With that overabundance of information, for sure.
Exactly. Right. And I think Jill really hit the nail on the head there, that having time to process these things, because you can't think of every question on day one. You take that and you have to think about it for a bit and then come back, because that question leads to another question. And, you know, when you're getting all that information in one visit, it's just difficult. I saw somebody last week who was actually going in for manipulation, and she was quite anxious about it and had some questions. And so we processed that over a couple of visits, and she came back afterward and she said, you know, the information you gave was really helpful, so that I was not anxious about how this was going to go, and I had a better understanding of what things were going to be like afterward.
And go ahead, Jill. Did you have a...
Well, the other thing that I think is helpful, kind of going along those lines of processing things, is have the patient think about everything they're doing during the day, because they kind of think, oh, I do this and I do that, but they may come up with something that's a little bit of a caveat. Oh, I'm going to go to my daughter's house and there's two steps to get in. I didn't think about that. How am I going to do stairs? Or gosh, I just thought of this. How do I get in and out of a car? So to kind of map out their days. And so as physical therapists or other healthcare professionals, we can address all those things, I think, is very helpful.
And don't be afraid to ask those questions, right? Sometimes
exactly.
I think people tend to be like, oh, I shouldn't ask, I should know. Or yeah. So great. So thanks for all that information, ladies. ladies. Let's go back over to the phone. We've got some people waiting with questions. First up, we have Barbara in Manitowoc. Hi, Barbara.
Hello there. How are you today?
Well, what can we help you with?
Well, I just had a comment. A year ago, approximately, I had two medial knee replacements, not at the same time, 8 weeks apart. And I do have a health background, which I found advantageous. But what I experienced was significant muscle tightening, both hamstring, quads, and calves afterwards. I spent almost 10 years walking like I had just gotten off riding a horse. So I think well, that's the best descriptor I can give.
It's pretty good. I can visualize it.
Yeah.
So my muscles had to relearn how to work correctly. And for whatever reason, I didn't think of that beforehand. So that was just my message that, you know, don't just give yourself a break and understand, you know, maybe you're going to have to stretch more than what you did beforehand, but it's okay. And let me tell you, life is wonderful post-surgery.
Good to hear.
That's really good to hear. And you're absolutely right. The muscles, if your joint had collapsed a little bit, the surrounding tissues may stretch a little bit initially when the prosthesis or the device is put in. Sounds like you had medial compartment DJD or arthritis just on the inside of your knee. And so that can certainly happen. And you're absolutely right. Muscles need to learn how to refire. The line of pull of your quadriceps may change a little bit with the change with the undersurface of the patella, the button. So all those things, you're right, your muscles have to learn how to rework again, and walking can be a little challenging, but things do settle down over time.
Right. And even if you're not going in for something like a realignment, it sounds like she had some alignment done with her surgery, that you may find that because of your hip pain or your knee pain or your foot pain, that you've been walking differently. And a lot of what we do is retrain you how to walk correctly. Sometimes people are completely avoiding using some muscle groups, and we can look and we can see the atrophy there. And we literally have to retrain them to use those muscles again that they've stopped using because it caused pain.
Is there anything she could have done pre-op to help with that?
My best guess is, you know, Barbara said she's in the healthcare profession. My best guess is that she sought medical care beforehand, and she probably had physical therapy beforehand and did everything appropriately. This is just one of those consequences of if you change the alignment of your knee, there's going to be some tissue remodeling.
Right. Great. Thank you very much for that question, Barbara, that comment, I should say. We're talking about physical therapy today. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today, and Trina LaSouza is our technical director. And this is PT Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. Our regular guests, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody, are with us. And we'd like you to join in if you have any questions about PT. Our number, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go back to the phones. We have Alan in Chicago who has a comment for us. Hi, Alan. Alan, are you there?
Here.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
Hi, I'm just wanting to make sure that I'm not going to get feedback through the radio. Anyway, my comment, healthcare is my background, pharmaceuticals, then medical devices. And in the last couple of years, I've had a quad tendon reattachment and then a rotator cuff and biceps tendon reattachment. And with that experience, having gone through physical therapy, that whole process twice fully, I would say that it was very frustrating, and I think probably the most frustrating thing about it was that, and I approached this, some of my background is also market research, but I approached it with just in an analytical perspective, and I felt that the big problem that I experienced was insurance companies carrying way too much weight in my rehab, meaning if I wanted to or felt that I could go a little bit faster or the other way around, it was all about what was expected by my insurance company and an accountable care organization. I would say that the physical therapists that I had, without saying that out loud, definitely confirmed it. Anyway, just to comment on the process.
Do one of you say that out loud?
Oh, yeah. I would start by saying, don't get me started. We only have an hour and a half. So I would agree that the third-party payers are a little bit like the tail wagging the dog. They try to get their, you know, healthcare providers to stay in a certain lane. But we know not all patients are the same. Not everyone heals at the same rate. Not everyone has the same comorbidities. You know, if you had a surgical procedure and you have diabetes, it may take you longer to heal than someone who does not have diabetes. So it takes a healthcare provider who is willing to go to the mat for you with their third-party payer to provide the rationale why we need to be seeing you at the frequency that we are seeing you and for the number of visits that we need to see you and for the interventions that are appropriate for you. So I would just say continue to, you know, support your healthcare providers who are working with the health insurance industry advocating for our patients.
Okay.
It's become very difficult. I can say as I'm old enough, which my sister loves, to remember the days when we saw people three times a week for an hour for 6 months following a surgical procedure.
Right.
And I understand that that's not right either, but there's not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to visits for physical therapy and other you know, interventions.
Sure. Thank you, Alan. Appreciate that, getting that point of view. And boy, that does not sound like fun to have those surgeries so close together.
No.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone here. We've got Anne in Middleton, and she's got a question. Hi, Anne. What can we help you with?
Hi. I am really excited to talk to you guys because it's very timely. I'm 56 years old, and I'm active, but I'm not a runner anymore. I can't do that. But I just came back from a five-day hiking trip in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and my knees are the things that bothered me the most. 30 years ago, my friends and I would just plan a trip, put a backpack on, and go. But this trip, we all found it was a lot harder during and after. So I carried a 24-pound pack, and what my knees ended up feeling like was like there's cotton batting stuffing in them. And my patellar tendons got sore, and we were basically hiking straight up and straight down 2,000 feet at a shot. And I did that at about 7 miles a day, and I did that for 4 days. So I'm proud of myself. I made it. But
yes.
Number one, I'm 56 and I'm only getting older, but I want to stay active like this and take more trips. And I'm wondering, number one, how do I recover well right now? And number two, what can I do to prepare for future trips?
Yeah, we remember those days when you could just roll out of bed and do all those things. And Lori and I can totally relate. We're doing a 7-day bike trip next week, and I'm doing way more preparation this year than I would have in the past. And I am 55, and so I'm right there with you. So let's talk about the here now. So you've kind of kicked off this inflammatory process in your knees. They're achy. The cotton batting sounds like they're probably a little swollen. You've irritated your patellar tendon. They need to be unloaded and rested. So plain and simple. So something that might be nice is some very gentle, minimal resistant biking to kind of flush your knees out. Your articular cartilage likes to be kind of bathed with bending and extending or flexing and extending. That would be great, especially because it'd be non-weight bearing. So you're not loading the joint. Getting in a pool would be fantastic. doing some really good stretching of your hamstrings, your gastroc, your quadriceps. Frequent stretching throughout the day would be fantastic. So that would kind of manage the here to now. I'm sure Lori has lots of ideas moving forward because you want to stay active, and you're right. You got to plan ahead a little bit for things
right.
like this. And there's really good ways to make your trip more enjoyable.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's one of the things that we're thinking about with our butts on a bike seat
that's
all
right.
day for 7 days. Like, you like to break that bad boy in a little bit. So,
yes.
you know, as we get older, our connective tissue does not recover as quickly as it did when we were younger. So it sounds like you went from 0 to 60. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear you discuss any preparation you did for this hiking trip. So, you know, not to overstate the obvious, but you need to keep hiking. You need to keep walking to prepare yourself for that trip so that when you go on a trip, it's not a dramatic change from your current activity level. So again, you don't start a week ahead or 2 weeks ahead. You start 3 or 4 months ahead if you're taking a big trip. But in the meantime, you keep walking, and you're walking hills, and you're stretching, and you're doing things so that when you go on a trip, this is not a new activity for your knees. Your knees say to you, oh, I've done this before. And the closer you get to your trip, then you start carrying a pack. You carry
right.
a load. We've had people in our fitness center here on our treadmills with a pack on their back, getting ready for trips, walking uphill. So
right.
that's what you need to do.
Yeah, same thing where my gym, Anne, which is very close to where you live, there's a track there. I see people with packs on all the time. They have one of those stair climbers, and I see people on those with packs. And so you got to kind of treat it just like that. I mean, many people think that hiking is just walking, and that's a huge increase in activity, very different terrain. And so, like Lori said,
right.
you got to train for it.
And honestly, it's the downhill that got you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always think, oh, it's so hard going uphill. So from a cardiorespiratory position, the uphill feels harder because it's harder on your cardiorespiratory system, but it's the downhill that's harder on your musculoskeletal system. So that's where you get we call the negative muscle contractions, where you're trying to slow your descent very hard on your muscle tendon unit. That's probably what gave you the patellar tendon issues.
Yeah.
So,
okay. Well, thank you, Anne, and congratulations.
Right.
That is quite a trip. Let's go to Kathy in Madison. She has a question. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. I found that I had a total hip replacement on my left hip. And what I was told is don't fall. Absolutely do not fall after surgery.
That's a great foot.
This is really good. But if you fall, there was no way of, you know, I wasn't trained to fall the right direction or however it is. They don't train you to fall. And the other thing was I did quite a bit of yoga. And before I had surgery was worse than after. So I figured out a way to get off the floor because I still had to scrub my floors. And so I trained myself to use yoga to get off. Yes, I do. I'm legally blind, and using a mop doesn't help me. So I got to get down and feel it. So anyway, and they don't teach you how, when you fall, to get back up again.
Kathy, you are singing my song. So we've done a couple research studies on the ability to get down and up from the floor in community-based elderly. And the ability to get down and get back up without assistance is closely linked to frailty, to morbidity, and to mortality, so as well as to being able to remain independent in your community. So one of the things that we emphasize here at UW when we see patients, particularly if you've had a hip or knee replacement, is to see that you can get down and get back up from the floor. Because if you fall and you can't get back up, that's a serious health risk for you. So some people can crawl to a piece of furniture and get up. But if you're outside, if you go out your back door in the winter to let your dog out and you fall and, you know, you don't have anyone to check on you and you can't get back up, that's a serious situation. So we want to be able to teach people to get back up if they can without use of a piece of furniture. So you're absolutely right.
Would it be best? Now, Kathy was doing yoga, but is that something you should definitely talk to your healthcare provider about before?
Absolutely. So it's definitely something as you go through the rehabilitation process that they should work with you and teach you how to safely get up and down off the floor. For sure. It's the same way with getting in and out of a car, all of those things, because we want people to remain independent, like Kathy said. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. And I have a number of patients, when I ask them, can you get down and up from the floor? They say, oh, no. And they just dismiss it as like, yeah, I don't need to do that anymore. But you need to be able to do that. We all fall at some point in time.
So. Some of us more than others.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. And we appreciate you calling and sharing that with us. Next, we have Nancy in New Berlin. Hi, Nancy. What can we help you with?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think I'm getting closer to needing knee replacement surgery after 40 years of running, hiking, walking. And I do get out 5 to 7 days a week and have tried steroid injections and the Symbis injection to minimal success. So I'm starting to make appointments with orthopedic surgeons, but I'm wondering if there is a more minimally invasive surgical procedure that they do now, that and is it available in our area? Just like the hip surgery was revolutionized about a decade or more ago with the frontal approach, I wonder if there's anything comparable with knees.
So one of the hip surgeries historically, not only a change in approach, but the other thing was it's preserved more of the femoral head or the ball part of the ball and socket joint, and it kind of just replaced the ball with just a cap versus completely taking off the ball and putting that long stem into your thigh bone. So that was probably one of the more minimally invasive changes we've seen with regards to hip arthroplasty in the past decade or so. So changes that we've seen with regards to total knees is what we call a partial knee replacement, where instead of replacing what we call a tri-compartment, so you have kind of the inside part of your knee, the outside part of your knee, and then the part of your knee where your kneecap rubs in there. It's called the three compartments. Sometimes they'll do what we call a unicompartmental total, or you can remember a joint replacement where they just replace one part. And we had a caller earlier who I believe had that done. And so that's much less invasive. So if you don't have arthritis in all three joints, just doing a unicompartmental total knee replacement would be less invasive.
Yeah. So in terms of the total knee replacement, about the only progress that's been made there in terms of the extent of surgery is to do a partial where you just do one compartment. Usually for most people, it's the medial compartment because that's the one that wears out most in people. So if your lateral compartment and your anterior compartment are in good shape, they can do a partial. But other than that, you're looking at the whole deal. And, you know, it's a tough surgery. It really is.
Right.
It is. So you need to be prepared. You need to have support at home. You need to clear the decks on your schedule so that you can really focus, especially for the first 8 to 12 weeks, focusing hard on restoring your motion. So.
But it does sound, you know, Nancy, it sounds like you've had steroid injections, you've had the Symbis, so it sounds like you've gone down a good conservative path from a medical management. I'm not sure if you've seen a physical therapist, but that would always be something that would be really good to do, even prior to surgery, to get your knee joint in the most healthy, optimal environment it could be going into surgery.
Okay, thank you so much, Nancy, and good luck with whatever way you go. We're talking about physical therapy with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. What questions are on your mind? We have some open lines, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email. That's ideas@wpr.org. Next, we have Bernie in Weston with a question. Hi, Bernie.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, so about a month ago, so I'm a pickleball player, been playing pretty regular for a year. I'm 64. About a month ago, I got a new paddle, and I started overswinging. And at one point, I had a really sharp pain in my elbow. So I've been kind of doing this self-treatment for tennis elbow since. But I'm really trying to figure out how hard to push it. I'm truly kind of stiff and sore in the morning. And I've been doing some Advil, some heat, some wrist exercises. But this is, you know, this is a really good time to play. So I'm really impatient. And I want to get out there. trying to understand how hard to push it.
That's a great question. So is your pain kind of on the outside of your elbow? Do you think it's truly tennis elbow kind of? Did you look at Dr.
Absolutely.
Google?
Yeah, okay. Outside, yep.
Okay. All right. So you've done a lot of things, I think, which could be helpful. The Advil, the heat, things like that. I would recommend seeing a physical therapist. That PT is going to help get you through this so you can continue to play. I know people are always concerned, oh my gosh, if I see a therapist, they're going to tell me to stop running, stop playing pickleball, things like that. And many times with some modification, we can keep you on the court, which is really important. So I think it's time to see a physical therapist and make sure that you're doing everything right. If it is truly lateral epicondylia in a 64-year-old male, it may take a little bit to get you better, but we can get you there. And Lori clearly has something to say.
Yeah, there are a number of things. They may try what's called a counterforce brace at your elbow. They may try a wrist splint, which helps with during periods of high activity. So some things to unload the tendon. And whenever I think of tennis elbow, I'm always reminded of some of the change in my philosophy over the years. So I remember sitting at the radio show with Bill Boisenault, my old buddy, probably 15 years ago, when we took the approach of, keep your exercise program within your pain tolerance. Right. If you are if you're having pain, you are overworking it. And then every once in a while, there'd be a caller who calls in who says, oh, I did that and I didn't get better. So I just said, what the heck? And I went to the gym and I picked up the heaviest weight I could. And I did wrist curls until I wept and my pain went away. And there is now research that supports some fairly heavy lifting to resolve some of these tendinopathies. So I just say go in with an open mind, listen to your physical therapist. And there are a number of different approaches to treat this problem. Jill's got something else. You go, girl.
The other thing, Bernie, because I play pickleball very poorly, but I play. The other thing is, since you got a new paddle and if you still have your old one, you may want to, instead of jumping in kind of like our hiker did previously, full go with that new paddle, you may want to do a little hybrid play, part of your pickleball with one paddle and part with the other, see if that kind of calms things down a little bit instead of just making this rapid change. That'd be another option for you. Stay out of the kitchen.
That's a pickleball reference, I believe.
That is a pickleball reference.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bernie. Much appreciated for that question. And let's go to Leslie in Cottage Grove. Hi, Leslie.
Hello. Thank you very much. I'm outside on cell phone. I'm coming through okay?
You are.
Yes.
Great. Thanks. I was having some terrible hip pain in my left hip. I thought I might need a hip replacement. I went to the doctor and had an x-ray, and no, I don't. There's minor hip dysplasia, but he suggested exercises, and so I upped my exercises on some, I do yoga and a 25-minute aerobic exercise. I'm still having a great deal of trouble with the piriformis muscle in that sometimes it'll quit when I'm going downstairs, and I've had a quick reach around the handrail. This is a scary problem.
Okay.
Dr. Google is telling me it might be an inflammation at the connection point on the leg.
All right.
So you're clear this is piriformis and not anything else?
I don't know. It's
okay.
It hurts in my hip. It does not bother. It doesn't cause sciatica. It's just
let me ask this. Where in your hip does it hurt?
Behind the bone that I can feel in my hip, I go backwards a little bit. The chiropractor said it was piriformis, but I'm not the doctor.
So it's sort of more in your buttock than it is on the outside or the groin.
Right. It's behind where your hip bone sticks out on the side.
It's behind there. So
it's behind the greater trunk.
Right. So chances are it's not your primary hip joint. Chances are it's muscular. It could be gluteal tendinopathy in that spot. It could be piriformis. It could be coming from your spine, depending upon whatever. So the fact that your hip joint itself got cleared tells you that you need to be focusing on something else. And since this area is sort of the no man's land, of the lower extremity, could be coming from your back, could be piriformis, could be pressing on your sciatic, could be gluteal tendinopathy. You should see a physical therapist so that they can do a good examination and sort out the source of the problem so that your exercise program can be directed toward it. Apparently, what you were given previously did not address the problem. So we need to look elsewhere and figure out where the pain is coming from.
Right. And that feeling you're getting when you go downstairs, that could be a pain inhibitory reflex. So if you get pain, a sudden jolt of pain, you can actually get a little reflex loop where it actually inhibits the muscle. And then the muscle kind of stops working momentarily. And that's when you have to grab that handrail. So that you might have a pain inhibitory reflex loop that's causing that kind of giving way. And a physical therapist would, with all the things they're doing, be able to kind of help that calm down as well.
Okay. Thank you, Leslie. Appreciate the call. We're talking about physical therapy with our regular guests, Laurie Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. What questions are on your mind? We have open lines. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. On the show tomorrow at 11, we'll take a look at fast fashion and the damage that it can do. And then at 11:45, we'll look at some of the acclaimed chefs that call Madison home. That's tomorrow, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. And right now, we have full lines and we've got some emails. And let's do an email from Anne in Brookfield. She couldn't stay with us, but she would like to know, what should someone do to live with femoral patella syndrome? She's 65 and exercises often, both walking and lifting weights, but she has bad knees and wonders what she can do to keep them healthy.
So it sounds like she was talking up about patellofemoral stress syndrome, we call it, and that's where you have usually some degenerative changes on the undersurface of your kneecap. It gives you pain in the front of your knee. We look at what's called the moviegoer sign, and that is you get pain in the front of your knee when you sit with your knees bent for long periods of time. So some of the things that we do for that are, first of all, keeping your quadriceps strong. So doing some strengthening exercises for your quadriceps, but avoiding ones that put too much pressure on your kneecap. So for example, a seated knee extension where you sit with your weight at the ankle and you straighten your knee out, that can be very hard on your kneecap. If you're doing squats, we look carefully at your posture, particularly the hip, knee, foot angle to make sure that you don't have too acute an angle there, because that will increase the stress on that kneecap. We advocate stretching of your quadriceps and hip flexors. And then we look at your overall posture to see if there's any postural abnormalities that might contribute to increased kneecap pain. And sometimes that's weakness at the hip. Sometimes it's a foot malalignment.
And I do think it sounds like Anne is pretty active. She's mentioned going to the gym, lifting weights, things like that. Anne should see a physical therapist to maybe have a modification done of her existing existing program. It might be just a few changes that really need to happen that she can incorporate at the gym that could make those changes, like Lori said. The other big thing with women and patellofemoral pain is we know that hip weakness is a contributing factor. And so making sure that she's got strong hips and that she uses those muscles to keep her legs in good alignment, like Lori alluded to.
When you say strong hips, Jill, what kind of exercise strengthens hips?
So the muscle or muscle group that we look at is the gluteus medius, or the muscles that abduct or take your leg out to the side. We've identified that many women have weakness with this, and then that kind of causes your leg to roll in or kind of fold in a little bit, like Lori was alluding to, and kind of impairs your alignment a little bit. So there's some very specific exercises that Anne could get specifically for what we'd call her gluteus medius and her posterior chain to really help strengthen her to kind of keep her alignment appropriate.
Okay, great. Lori, did you have something else to add?
Well, I was going to say, for some of those people who have been in physical therapy, the clam.
Yep.
It's a fairly common one. If you can be on your knees, the fire hydrant is another one that works that muscle group. And I like one where you, with your legs straight out and resistance around the balls of your feet, like with the band, where you roll your feet out. I call them hip turnouts.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the exercises that work that outside and posterior muscle group.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And let's go back to the phones. Patricia in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Patricia.
Good day. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
I had a meniscus tear on my right knee, and they repaired it. And then I got an insufficiency fracture on my medial condyle. And I've seen two orthopedic surgeons, and I don't have any trouble walking, though I have to keep my knee slightly bent. I can go up and down stairs with no pain. I don't have any pain when I'm at rest or anything like that, or when I'm driving. But when I talked to the orthopedics, they talked about a partial. But when I read the after-action report by the orthopedist, he said, you know, she's 72 years old. She has osteoporosis, and this might not be a good long-term type thing to do. So I'm just wondering what I am. I do exercise regularly. I, like I said, walking. I just have to remember to keep the knee slightly bent.
So why do you keep the knee slightly bent when you're walking, or when you're walking?
If I extend it, it hurts. It's sort of like, okay. You know what it's like when you're walking and you step in a hole?
Yes.
That jars up through my joint in my knee, and it's painful. One doctor described it as I have a pothole in my joint.
Okay, because of the insufficiency fracture?
Yes.
And that has not healed?
I think it's healed about as good as it's going to at this stage, because it's been 2 years. So
do you think it's an insufficiency fracture with an articular cartilage defect? Is that what you're thinking, Lori?
Yeah, there must be.
That's what I'm thinking too. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So what Lori and I were talking about is, did that fracture kind of take a divot or a pothole out of your articular cartilage, which is part of the covering of your knee, which would make sense that if you walked with a flexed knee gait, you could avoid kind of hitting that pothole per se. So they were concerned about doing a partial total knee on you because of your osteoporosis, Patricia, is that right?
Well, mostly I think because of my age.
You're not that old for
it. Yeah, you're young.
So. I'm wondering, so as you said that, Jill, I'm wondering about that insufficiency fracture, if it's not the articular cartilage that has the pothole, but if it's the bone, if the bone has collapsed there, and if they went in and tried to do even a partial knee replacement, if they would get further collapse of the bone, if there's not enough bony structure there to support the replacement.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so having said all that, then your options are to get your muscles as absolutely strong as you can, Patricia, to make sure that those muscles can offload the joint. So making sure you have really good strength in your quadriceps and your hamstrings and your entire lower body would be very important. And I would also, because of your age, just make sure you had really good balance. We talked earlier in the show about balance and being able to get up and down off of the floor. All those things would be very important.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that concerns me is you're walking with a partially flexed knee. Right. There are two things about that. One is it effectively gives you a leg length difference left mm-hmm. to right, which means you're going to be loading stuff differently all through the kinetic chain, which is not great. And it's that sort of 15 degrees of full straight to slightly bent where the shock absorption happens. So you are really heavily loading what remains of your articular cartilage and that bony structure by walking with your knee partially bent. Eventually, unless you work to keep your knee straight in a non-weight bearing position, you're going to lose that full extension motion at your knee. You're going to maybe get some fibrosis there, which is not going to be pretty either. If you haven't seen a physical therapist, I think you need to find a good one who can help you with this. And part of me wonders if you should be walking with a normal gait with an assistive device some of the time so that you maintain that range of motion and that mobility, and also a normal gait pattern in a pool where right. you don't have all your weight on it would be good. So I think there are a number of strategies you can work with here, but you need a good physical therapist to help shepherd you through this.
Right.
Okay, thank you so much, Patricia, and good luck with that. Steve in Boscobel, you're up next. What can we help you with?
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I've had two hips replaced on the right side. One had bad parts. They just replaced my knee back in January, and it feels now that I walk like my hip joint is loose. The doctor says it's not loose, but I can feel like a clicking going on in there. That wouldn't be the T-band, would it?
The IT band.
Now that I'm walking different?
It could be.
Could be. Is the click painful, most importantly, Steve, or is it just a click?
No, it's just a click. It's annoying as heck. And if I'm real busy, I don't even notice it. But when I'm just walking casually, then I start noticing again, and it just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, you know, if it's not associated with pain, we don't lose a lot of sleep over it. We could spend a lot of time trying to chase down a click. Most people snap, crackle, pop here and there. So given that you've had two hip replacements on that side and a knee replacement, if it's not hurting, I'd try to just take my mind someplace else and not lose a lot of sleep over it. Just make sure you're doing all your stretching and all the things you're supposed to be doing. It could be that you're walking differently and moving differently now that you have that knee replaced, and so you're sort of, you know, firing up something that you didn't encounter before. But if it's not hurting and everything else is looking good, I'd try to just ignore it if I could.
Yeah. Kind of like ignoring tinnitus. So kind of the same thing there. Yeah. Thanks, Steve. Good luck with that. Let's take an email. Karen sent this. She's a year out from a total knee replacement, and she's doing well. But she'd love to know if there's a more graceful way to get up from the floor or a low lawn chair other than putting her rear end up in the air. She said it's not a pretty view at concerts on the square, etc. And she can't bend that knee enough to stand from a low chair.
Oh, so that's, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, first of all, I guess my first recommendation would be, and I know it sounds kind of facetious, but get a higher chair. I mean, does she, we will talk about getting up off the floor because that is very important. But could she sit in a little bit higher chair?
Yeah.
So that would be the first thing.
Yeah. So getting up from the ground, you should be able to do this. So, you know, you start out, we call it inside sitting, where if you think of a lady sitting on the ground with her knees bent out to one side, then you come up to tall kneeling, which is kneeling on both knees. And then you go to what's called half kneeling, where you put one foot in front of the other. Those of us who had 12 years of Catholic school call it a genuflect.
Or the will you marry me.
Or will you marry me? That's better, Jill. I just take the religion out of it there. And so maybe that knee replacement doesn't bend enough for you to kneel on it, but you should be able to put it out in front of you and then put your hands on that knee and kind of push down on that knee and push yourself up. that would be the strategy we would recommend trying.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much for that call. I'm sure the people behind you really don't care. So,
right.
Let's take another call. And we'll probably, you might be able to help him out. Doug in Solon Springs, what's your question? We just have like a minute before we have to break, but go ahead.
Well, I get discomfort under one kneecap. It's happened for a couple of years now. When I transitioned from almost daily cross-country skiing to no more skiing and activity around the lake, which includes a lot of stair climbing, and yet some stairs, like inside our house, which are at a different angle, don't seem to bother me so much. Last year, it seemed to go away after maybe a month or so. This year, it's kind of lingering on.
Okay. Well, we've got 30 seconds. Can you guys address that, or should we wait till after the break?
Well, we can get started. It sounds like patellofemoral pain, which yep. we addressed earlier. So cross-country skiing is much easier on your kneecaps than is stair climbing.
Okay, well, we will continue after that. We're talking about physical therapy with our regular guests, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. And we'll be right back after this break for the news. Thank you. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for spending some of your time with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about physical therapy with our regular guest. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Lori Tyne-Brody is a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. What questions do you have for them? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And before we broke for the news, we were talking with Doug in Solon Springs, and he was having some discomfort under his kneecaps. And Lori, I think you had started to explain what he could possibly do. Go ahead.
Right. So it's a... Anytime you change activity, you're going to change the loading across your joints. So changing from cross-country skiing to a kind of hiking where you're doing a lot of stairs, which is what Doug was doing, the stairs are really going to increase the kneecap pain. And he also remarked that the stairs were different in his home because they were at a different angle. And it's all so perfect because, again, not all stairs are the same. And, you know, some people can do stairs, some can do some stairs, but not other stairs. A lot of it has to do with these angles. So, you know, the suggestion would be to work into that change in activity a little more slowly instead of stopping skiing, then all of a sudden going and doing a lot of stairs, you know, kind of like at the beginning of this call show here where we had the woman who went hiking after not hiking for a while. It's a big change in activity level across your kneecap. So for now, he should try to back down on some of the stairs that are painful, do some stretching for his quadriceps. If his knees are sore, some icing can help. And Jill, I don't know if you had any other suggestions.
No, I think that's great. I think what it comes down to is the whole concept you talked about is, you know, we're comparing apples to oranges here a little bit. I mean, Doug is using his legs for both of these activities, but he's using them very differently. And so it's that mindset that people have, well, gosh, I've been using my legs for this. Why is this activity making me sore? Well, the contraction type is different. The range of motion is different. And you have to consider all of those things.
Okay, thank you very much, Doug. Next up is Marty in Northwest Wisconsin. Hi, Marty. What can we help you with?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm wondering what you would suggest for pudendal nerve pain. I spent a year and a half with pelvic floor PTs, kind of smoothing things out there, by the way, doing God's work, those women. I can't
yes,
thank them
they
all
are.
Enough. Oh, my gosh. So it has sort of unraveled now. There is some pudendal nerve. No one has said specifically neuralgia, entrapment. I don't know. But I'll be seeing her for the third time this week, working with a PT who does some nerve relief work. But I'm always curious to hear what you guys have to say about things.
Do you have any idea where this came from? Like how this started or anything?
Maybe 10 years ago when I slid off a bike seat and landed bang on the cross on the bar of the bike. Could have been the beginning of it. And then I was doing a lot of squats and some getting up off the floor, speaking about getting off the floor, where I would just squat and then stand up. So I think I overworked muscles around it. But I think that injury maybe was a contributing factor as well.
We're all cringing.
Sure. Right. We're all cringing.
We're all cringing.
Jill and I thinking about getting on our bikes this week. Yeah. Being real careful, maybe putting a noodle over that
the crossbar. Yeah. The crossbar, that top tube. Oh, boy. Yeah. So yes, a women's health physical therapist, did, as you had mentioned, Marty, is a really good place to go. Many of them are trained to perform and treat patients internally, so they can do an internal exam, things like that. So, what else do I have to offer you? Boy, yeah. Not much. Yeah. Unless there be some sort of, if they're considering some sort of release on it, surgically or something like that, that'd be the only thought I'd have.
So, you know, when you said you were overworking we work a lot here with our pelvic floor physical therapists, and often what we see is too much tone in that area. So for those people who have weakness in some areas, there are many women who have too much tone in their pelvic floor, and that's what is causing some of their symptoms. So working on releasing, relaxation techniques. When they send those folks to the pool, they often want them doing backwards walking rather than forward to decrease the tone in the pelvic floor. So those are some of the things that they often suggest. So you know, talking to your physical therapist and asking, is this too much tone? Do I need to be working on relaxation techniques or things to decrease the tone in the area rather than increasing the strength of these muscles?
Okay, thank you, Marty. Hope that works out well for you. Let's go next to Darcy in Madison. Hi, Darcy. How can we help you?
Hi, I'm calling about my husband who has what he claims is an old baseball injury in his elbow. He has it's on the back side of the elbow, and there's kind of a groove there, and it is, he has like a half of a finger shaped swelling there, and so it's not like a regular, it might be a tricep injury. He's not using it very much because it's painful. It's not painful at rest if he puts it in a leans his arm against something or like a chair rest or puts it in a sling, which he's been doing. It's not painful at that time, but when he goes to even like open a jar or something, it's the twisting motion that he says is painful. And he has icing it and putting like an elbow brace on it, but it's not really helping very much.
Laura, are you thinking ulnar neuritis or are you thinking olecranon bursa?
I was thinking both those things.
Me too.
For a while. And then, but then I'm wondering, Darcy, if you say an old baseball injury, like how long has this been bothering him? Has he been doing this icing and slinging stuff for a long time?
He's only been doing that for a couple of weeks, and he's 70. I should have said that. And
right.
He hasn't played baseball in a long time, but he was a baseball coach up until about 15 years ago. But
so,
now he can't. He's a volunteer at the Mallards. He's one of the foul liners, and so he has to throw balls to the kids in the stands, and he can't hardly do that anymore. And that was prior to this injury, but he claims that the baseball injury, but
I wonder if he's got a little bit of valgus instability and he's got some ulnar neuritis in his ulnar groove.
and maybe some OCD on the lateral side.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So, okay. we've sorted it all out for you, Darcy.
Yes, we need to get him throwing. We need to get him throwing those balls back to those kids at the Mallards game. I think, first of all, we both think your husband should see a physical therapist. So he's got an extensive history of elbow use from all of his baseball activity and baseball coaching. Because of throwing mechanics with baseball, he could have a little bit of what we'd call collapse or compression on the outside of his elbow. And when you do that, you also tension or stretch things on the inside of your elbow. One of the things that can happen is your ulnar nerve. So when he goes to try and grip something, i.e. like a baseball, and he has to twist a little bit, he may have some inherent weakness there because he's irritating his ulnar nerve. So he should see a physical therapist who can do an evaluation and make sure his joint has good mobility, he has good range of motion, that he doesn't have any scar tissue there, which is going to kind of hold the ulnar nerve in place and put him on a rehabilitation program. So yeah. We're glad you called. He's probably not happy because you had to call for him, but no, it's really good, and he should definitely see a physical therapist.
And he is correct. It is probably an old baseball
injury. Right, that's exactly right.
But but that's not a 25-year-old elbow anymore, so he needs a little bit of help.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Darcy. Tom in Madison, you're up next. What's your question? Tom, are you there? Tom? Oh. Okay, let's go to Tom. Tom, are you there? Oh, Tom, are you there? Sorry. I think we just had a little mix up. Teresa, if you want to call back, we'll get you back on. But Tom, are you there? Okay.
I'm trying to.
Okay, go ahead. We can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. I just got a smartphone. Excuse me.
That's okay. No problem.
I have right hip arthritis, and I've been living with it for a while. I don't know whether I should get a steroid or cortisone injection before I get a hip replacement. And then if I do get a hip replacement, I'm trying to decide whether I get anterior, lateral, or posterior. And then to choose an orthopedic doctor, do they check to see if they've had any, you know, bad experiences as a result of hip replacements? I know two women who've had anterior, and one it turned out okay. The other one, she developed foot drop. He must have hit the nerve or something. So I guess I'm a little bit afraid of some of these things going on with hip replacements.
Right. Well, those are all very good questions. So before we even go down the path of a steroid injection or anything invasive, have you seen a physical therapist, Tom?
Yes, I have seen one several times.
Great.
And I've been approved for a hip replacement, and I still walk around. You know, I feel pain, but I use a cane and I get around and I get my exercise every day.
Okay, good. So you're doing your exercise and you've tried to get as strong as you can and all those things, and now we're looking at the next steps for you. So I think the first thing to do would be to, if you have not met with an orthopedic surgeon, would be to meet with an orthopedic surgeon and see where that individual thinks you are with regards to a total hip replacement. So perhaps they can look and say, we could try a steroid injection, and based on my experience, it might get you some time. Or they may say, you know, I don't think a steroid injection is going to be beneficial for you. Let's start considering a little bit more about surgical options we have for you. So I think getting in a connection and starting and establishing a relationship and establishing care with an orthopedic surgeon is probably the next way to go. And then I'll just throw in my two cents for a posterior approach or an anterior approach. So first of all, you always want to ask the surgeon which one they're trained in, which one they prefer, and what their outcomes are for both. So, and which one you would be a better candidate for. There's many people who like the anterolateral approach. There's many people who like the posterolateral approach. So I think you need to gather all that data from the surgeon prior to having any decisions made. Lori?
So one of the things to think about with the cortisone injection is if you do get a cortisone injection, they won't do a hip replacement for at least 3 months. Right. So it pushes your timeline out. So just keep that in mind in case you decide, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go get a injection. Oh, that didn't work. Now I want my hip replaced. You're looking at a couple months waiting for that. And, you know, most of the time what our surgeons will say is, you know, your hip looks bad enough. We could do a hip replacement. You let us know when you are ready. And that's when the bad days are winning, when you start cutting back on your activities, when you're not as social as you want, when your walks get shorter and shorter, and your world is getting smaller and smaller. We want to intervene before it gets to be that bad. You develop, you know, changes in your gait, you start overloading other joints, and then they get sore. We want to stop that downward spiral and do that replacement when it's the right time. So, and then in terms of picking that surgeon, Jill gave you some really good suggestions there, but also meet with more than one and mm-hmm. see who you are most comfortable with.
Okay.
So I would suggest that as well.
All right, great. Thank you, Tom, for that question. We've got some emails. And by the way, we do have a couple of open lines. So if anybody has any questions, 800-642-1234. Or like I said, you can send an email, but we've got a number of them, so we might not get to yours right away. Jane sent us an email. She is wondering if you can suggest a walking stick that you may like or people like.
I think I'll let Lori handle that. I think she's got a couple that are collapsible that you had mentioned. I don't know if you can remember a brand or anything off, but I know you've talked about the ones that fold
up. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Go ahead, Lori.
Yeah, I don't have a specific brand in mind. I would just go check them out, walk with them, put your hands on them, see how they feel. But in general, I think the collapsible kind are really useful because they travel so well. You can throw them in your car. You can carry them along when you're out on a hike. And if you don't need them for the first half, great. And then you can use them for the second half if you start to get sore. And if you're traveling by plane, et cetera, they're easy to transport with you.
Okay. And I do have to say, from my own opinion, I've been using the ExerStrider poles that were developed by a gentleman here in Madison, and I absolutely love those. So if that's helpful, check them out. I think you can get them online. So, and let's see. Oh, we do have a caller here. Larry in Bloomington, Minnesota has a question. Hi, Larry. What can we help you with?
Good morning. This is really a pre-operative question in terms of making a decision. 12 years ago, I had both knees replaced, and 10 years ago, I had my hip replaced. And I just went to my orthopedist and hip person, and I'm due for another hip replacement. Both other ones went fine. But I also have a degenerative disc in my neck and bone spurs, so I've been having neck issues too. So I've also looked at another orthopedist to have a neck fusion. So my question is, none of these are chronic. They don't cause me any issue except when I try to sleep. I try to sleep, my hip hurts, I turn one way, and then my neck hurts, I turn the other way. And I have been taking I can take Advil. But the question is, how do you make a decision in terms of, you know, before it was pain versus quality of life. None of these are bothering me directly, but how do I know which one, how do I make a determination which one to do first? And related to that, should I take Advil or not acetaminophen continually for the pain when I'm trying to sleep?
Well, those are all really good questions. I think one of the first things, since it's a sleep only, is I would see if a change in a mattress or pillow or a sleep, a body pillow or anything like that could offer you some sort of comfort. Maybe an egg crate mattress or something like that to abate some of these symptoms. I think that would be kind of my first line of defense before I kind of went down a path of surgery or anything like that. And then with regards to medication, you always got to be really careful and make sure that they're not interfering with any of your other medications. Some people like to take melatonin instead of a sleep agent or anything like that because it's something your body naturally produces. And so it seems to interact better with prescription medications than other like Ambien or things like that.
Okay.
Lori, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. You know, in terms of surgery, you know, we try to put that off as long as we possibly can, as long as it's not impacting your function. So as long as you're still able to do all the things that you want to do, maybe with a little bit of modification, you know, we go with that. And one of the things that crossed my mind is, you know, if you have your other hip replaced, you're going to be on an assisted device, and that's certainly going to impact your neck with that weight bearing on your hands. So it's something to think about. You want to make sure your neck is able to manage the post-operative challenges of a hip replacement.
Okay, thank you, Larry. I think we've got time for one more question. We got Rick in Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. I'm 67 and got a bunch of issues, but I would say the most pain I'm in is from my neck. It's just constant. Sometimes I get stingers. You know, you turn and it's a sharp pain. It's almost always some level of pain, especially waking up in the morning. And I'm just wondering if there's physical therapy for that. The other question is I have a fairly well torn ACL. I feel it most times walking my dog, uneven terrain. I'm wondering if that is a candidate for what you were referring to earlier as a total knee replacement, or if they just maybe replace the ACL with, I don't know what, Gore-Tex.
Sorry to cut you off there, Rick, but we're running out of time. So which one do you want to address, ladies?
Well, really quickly, a physical therapist could address
Go
both
ahead,
of
Jill.
These. A physical therapist could address both of these issues. So yes, the stingers, you may have some degenerative changes or something like that. So seeing a physical therapist for appropriate exercises, stretching, traction, whatever would be helpful. And then with regards to the ACL deficient knee, starting with a conservative program with adequate strengthening and proprioception is probably a really good way to go. So I think both of those things would be amenable to physical therapy. That'd be your probably first line of defense for both.
Okay. Lori, do you want to add to that? Got a minute?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. So the stuff that's happening in your neck is probably the result of some degenerative changes. And it'd be really important to address that because it's not going to get better on its own. It will only get worse, and you'll find that you're losing mobility. You're learning the ability to turn and look over your shoulder. It's going to impact your ability to drive. It will impact your sleep. So there may be some very simple things that you can be taught to do to help with those symptoms and prevent that from getting any worse.
Okay, great. And thank you so much, Jill and Lori. We appreciate you being with us once again. And good luck on your bike ride next week.
Thanks.
Yep. We've been talking with Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum. She is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Lori Tyne-Brody. She is a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Join us again tomorrow when we talk about the true cost of cheap clothing. And then at 11:45, we'll highlight Madison chefs and their establishments. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.